tonight on Arena. Butler, Blake and Grant perform live, new poetry from Anne-Marie Nicoron, and Dublin Gothic for Christmas at the Abbey Theatre. You can, of course, text us as usual on 51551. Our email is arena@rte.ie, and we're on Instagram at @rte_arena. Bernard Butler, Norman Blake and James Grant first performed together after being invited to take part in a small show in South Lanarkshire. The collaboration developed into further concerts, eventually leading to the recording of the first album as a trio, Butler, Blake and Grant, created at Norman Blake's home studio on the banks of the River Clyde. Bernard Butler came to prominence as a guitarist with Suede. He has since worked extensively as a producer and collaborator. Norman Blake is a founding member of Teenage Fan Club, known for its melodic guitar-driven songwriting. And James Grant is the writer, guitarist and singer formerly of the Glasgow band Love and Money. They're currently on an Irish tour with dates in Kilkenny, Galway, Belfast and Dublin, and I'm genuinely delighted to welcome them to Arena. Good evening.
Good evening.
Norman, I'll start with you maybe. You've each carved out such distinct careers, yourself at Teenage Fan Club and James with Love and Money and Bernard with Suede, McCammon and Butler, your solo work as a producer, all of that stuff that's all happened for all of you. So when the three of you first sat down with guitars, did you immediately hear how all of those distinct things might come together?
Yeah, I mean, it came together pretty easily, actually. I mean, it was, I think the, initially, we'd all been invited to play, our friend Douglas McIntyre has a club or a venue thing that he runs called Frets. We'd all been invited individually to do it. And then I think he'd come up with the idea that it might work if he put us together. So, I mean, I think initially we all agreed, we all thought it would work. And myself and James kind of got together in Glasgow and played, thought, okay, this is pretty good. I'd known Bernard for a long time. We've known each other since way back in the early 90s, haven't we? Mm-hmm. And myself and James were acquainted in Glasgow. But, I mean, yeah, we just sort of, we liked the idea conceptually. And then we got together and sat, you know, go around, you have three guitars and just started playing. And
I guess none of us was all over it. We were all quite respectful of, and I think we all found a space like quite quickly. You know, there was like just certain things just seemed to kick in. You know, like in Bernard's tracks, for example, we just homed in a kind of hold back and vocal thing. Yeah. And yeah, and I guess we just sort of thought there was some kind of alchemy there.
Yeah. What about that for you, Bernard? That first time where the three of you sit down together and you start playing, you start thinking about maybe putting something together. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, any collaboration, I've done a lot, we've all done lots of it, and I've done a hell of a lot of it. You kind of have to find a reason for doing it, like a point, you know. So like James said, you have to find a space. So if it's the first time you're doing it, you just play all over everything and you don't get it. But you have to find a reason to, okay, why should I be here? Where's the space and what do you add? You know, what can you do to change the dynamic? So, I mean, the first obvious thing is I generally play electric and then play acoustic. So in a sonic thing where you haven't got much to play with, we haven't got any drums, bass, it's just a couple of guitars. So I play an electric guitar. That evolved into Norman generally plays with this Nashville tuning now, which is this quite wiry, quite thin and higher register guitar sound. You know, we found a sort of a sonic space with the guitars and the voices. Voices are always just DNA. You know, you're stuck with it. And you when they come together, you think, well, that's a sound, and it becomes unique. You know, when people sing harmonies together, you know, for better or worse, you know, it's a unified thing that it was like that the first time we played. I mean, the first thing I noticed really, particularly on my tunes, so happy just to join in on their tunes, but with my tunes, I hadn't heard that anybody do that before. They just added these harmonies and little parts, and it was just so nice to sit back and think, wow, I don't do that, and that's great. Somebody else can do that, and I really enjoyed that element of this, hearing my songs performed, two-thirds of it performed by somebody else.
I think initially we were all more interested in the other person's tunes. You know, I play my tunes a lot in the course of, like, my solo stuff and all that. I'm always out gigging. So I wasn't I'm a fan of the other guy's music, but I was more interested in doing Norman's tunes and Bernard's tunes, and I think vice versa. So you like Bernard says, you were kind of a bit like, what can I bring to the table here? And sometimes I think when you work with really good musicians, they listen. They don't just play all over it and just play the chords or whatever. They think, what can I do here that enhances it? And sometimes it means you're not singing for a verse or whatever, or you're not playing anything, you're playing very little. But it kind of felt like something good was happening.
But there's also the flip side of that, isn't there, as well, in terms of you have your own tunes which are now being interpreted by two other people as well. What was that like, James, in terms of hearing other people look at your songs through their lens?
To be honest, I thought, like, there's one of my tunes, Winter, and the guys just seemed to get it. And that was a song we made, like, in Love and Money, we probably demoed, like, 3 times. And we couldn't get it to sit. And one of the times we did it, it was, the idea of it initially was, like, it would be, like, me sitting on a porch playing the guitar and the band would sort of creep into it. And it's more like that now than it ever was with my band, because I think it's quite difficult with a band to tell for them not to play. Some of the times, you know, you would sit in a rehearsal and say, and I would explain, you know, this is kind of how I foresee this. So basically everybody would just wait to the second verse and then steam in. You know, and you're like, that's not really what I meant. But I guess it's that experience thing, you know. I feel... We have another record coming out next year, which is like some our collective older material, and I really love the version that we did of that particular song, in the sense that I feel that it's closer to the original conception of it.
Yeah, we're not kind of listening to the original versions as a reference point for these. We're going kind of in cold, and you know. One of the songs, one of my songs on there, called Dark and Lonely Night. I don't think you guys have maybe heard it.
I hadn't heard it. I didn't
listen to it because Teenage Fan Club had done a version as a B-side way back in the midst of time. Those guys intentionally didn't listen to it and, you know, just interpreted or, you know, extrapolated from what I was playing. I just sort of played the basic melody and here are the chords, and then they, you know, did their thing. And that's really good. I think we've all, I think I probably do speak for all of us, and then maybe when you're younger as an artist, you're maybe a bit more controlling of, I'll speak for myself, okay, because I don't want to speak for you guys.
I hear what you're saying.
When I was a younger artist, I had an idea for a song, I would kind of have an idea of how I would like the drums to sound or the bass to sound, whatever, you know. But certainly with Teenage Fan Club and the last few albums, I don't do that at all, because the guys are great musicians. So come in with a basic idea, and you know that these people are creative and they'll maybe enhance it and take it somewhere else. And that's what we kind of do with this.
In terms of all of this then, Bernard, and it seems to be part of the discussion that's being had here. Obviously, if you were approaching this when you were in your 20s, this isn't possibly something that couldn't have happened, whereas now, given the nature of the age that you all are, it's something that's just much easier.
Yeah, I mean, experience, you know, and just being around situations. I guess when you're young as well, you want to do everything on your first record, everything, just get everything out of the way, everything you've dreamed of or thought about. And of course, the problem is you don't know how any of those things happen, because you're doing it for the first time. And then you spend years actually around other people and seeing how things work, and it all becomes second nature, you know, and it's much easier, yeah. It definitely couldn't have happened, but, I mean, part of it is we're kind of not a group in that sense of rock and roll groups, like they're both describing, you know, the drummer and the bass player always have to come in. You know, I remember being being a Suede, you know, and having to sort of explain that politely. I've got this idea and... it doesn't involve you, I'm afraid. How do I say this, you know? And it caused all sorts of trouble. And it was never because it was a personal thing. It's always because, as Norman was saying, I just that's the idea, you know, this is part of the thing. And I've sketched this all out in my head. And I really need this to happen. And it became hell on earth to get this past people personally. And but now I don't ever encounter that situation. I would never encounter that situation because everyone I work with and the way you work, it has that sensibility where, like James said, you might just sit out for a verse or just sit out entirely.
Have to be confident enough to not play.
Serve the song is the cliche, you know.
Like the song is king.
Yeah, the song is king.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, yeah, you just do what's the best thing. And part of this, when sometimes on... I really enjoy sometimes on in this setup where I'm just singing and not playing guitar because James kicks off a song and I just like listening. And things like that are really nice part of what we do here.
I'm going to ask you to play something for us. You're going to play Bring an End, which starts the album. It came together almost by accident, though. Norman's phone fragment, James's notebook, yep. And then suddenly this kind of finished song. Has that kind of spontaneous spark, Bernard, become an important part of what you do as a group?
Yeah, so how we recorded these... we got together over, I think there was two or three sessions. We hung out at Norman's place in like the country in the south of Glasgow, and for like two or three days at a time, and we'd each come up with a couple of songs. And I wish you did have a studio there set up, but it was really a case of sitting on the two facing each other on two sofas, and we just played some songs and then just grabbing some mics,
yeah,
and sticking them out. There was no headphones, nothing like we've got right here, and just literally some microphones capture the sound of whatever's happening, but the really great thing about that is you're listening to each other, just what you're hearing in the room together and playing off each other. And I remember doing this song, Bring an End. It was the last one. I think it was the last one that we recorded. Yeah. And these guys got it together. And I was messing about with some mic cables or something like that, and I heard them just doing it. And I just jumped in and recorded, and I jumped in on the guitar and just caught it in that way. It was really nice. There was no kind of grand vision for how musically it would evolve. Yeah. It just evolved in a really nice environment. Yeah. And we were talking about this great room we're in right now, and we're all sort of singing the praises, how important this is. I'm a big believer of environments, in all art forms, they really create what you do, and they set your mind, and they set your how you feel, and this great room is like that. And with Norman's as well, we're just sitting, we're not in a recording studio at all. We're just sitting around on some armchairs, and mm-hmm. that really creates that feeling and that mindset when you go to play.
I suppose another factor is, speaking personally, I'd never made a record like that where the three of you are just sitting around and you just do it. Mm-hmm. And things were coming together very, very quickly. It's just, it takes a wee bit of bravado to do it. You need to kind of let yourself go, let your guard down a wee bit. And I really loved it. And there was just that whole kind of thing. It's like that feeling when you just couldn't wait to get to work. I would sometimes drive home at night and then couldn't wait to get back the next day and like loads of ideas for what to do. And we were all just grabbing stuff and playing, and it came together really, really quickly, and I have to say painlessly.
No pressure. And this song, as you say, it was a fragment. As any musician listening in will do exactly the same thing. We'll get the phone and they'll record a little something on it, 20, 30 seconds. This is a song, was something that I had a melody for and I had a kind of, basic structure for. And I think I had one of these songs that I had for a while, and I couldn't get a lyric for it. And I thought, well, I'll just ask James if he had one. James has a notebook with lots of different lyrics in there, and you had a look through and thought
it was just quite random.
Had something that fit, and then the next day we had the song. So it was, and then we recorded it that day. Amazing. So.
I should clarify, given all the praise, that we are not in our current studio at the moment. We're in the legendary Studio 8 in RTE's radio building. But this is Butler, Blake and Grant, and this is Bring an End.
Dug a hole deep inside myself, in earth I should have kept until it's time to set things to rights, pull the weeds, sow new seeds, holes can be filled. Bring an end to this ugliness. Let the new season begin. So scared I'd lose you. I'm nothing left to hold on to. And so we hold on to the we shared suburban moments. You need speak to us on the sly. We both know we should just bring an end to this ugliness. Let the new season begin. I didn't mean to disabuse you. I was just so scared I'd lose you. Left to hold on to. So we hold on to love.
That is Butler, Blake and Grant doing Bring an End here on Arena. Maybe, James, I'll ask you this one. The live shows, they kind of have a reputation for being a bit, you know, a bit loose, full of humour. Obviously, because you don't have drums and bass, you don't have a full band. What does stripping those songs back to the bare bones mean for like a live performance?
We haven't really given any thought to any of it. You know, it was... Initially, when we did it, I think there was, going back to what I was saying earlier when we were asked to do this, Norman and I had a phone call, and I just sort of said, like, songwriter circle things. Traditionally, it's basically one person plays a song, and the other two or three or whatever it is sit around looking moved. and I just sort of thought, I don't fancy that. I'd rather... chip in, play a bit of guitar, sing some backing vocals, and we all sort of agreed that was like a better shout, you know, in doing this. And then we were having a laugh as well, and we just, I don't know, I suppose nothing was ever planned. You know, it isn't like we decided we would try and be funny or something or whatever, there would be a bit of patter. It just all kind of happened.
There's almost a structure of traditional music or folk music about the way that you do that.
Yeah, I guess so. But like I say, it was never a plan. You know, it all seemed pretty innate in what we were doing initially. And I guess, ridiculously relaxed first couple of gigs.
I mean, it's good for coming from a band context, it's brilliant. Maybe not so much for Bernard, because he still has to lug the amp around. But for me, James, we just shop with an acoustic guitar, plug it in, and we're good. It's a really laid-back thing. We do a couple of covers in this show, but we've kind of settled on a sort of structure. The songs have certainly developed arrangement-wise. You know, they're more dynamic, I think, in a way. We've sort of honed it over time, but it's been a very easy sort of process.
Bernard, in terms of the songs that you play then, fans will also hear songs drawn from all of your back catalogues, from Suede and Teenage Fan Club and Love and Money and solo work. So how do you decide what songs make the cut?
That's a good question. Again, like James, do we actually make any decisions about anything? I'm not sure we do.
I think I kind of thought...
It's so random, the whole thing.
Songs that might be easy to play is maybe your initial thought. For me, yeah.
There's certain things that I find more fun from my back catalogue, as they call it, and like James said, there's things that I much prefer playing in this format than I do playing on my own, and I purposefully pick those ones, that I enjoy doing.
What about you, Norman? Did you make any conscious push for a song you thought might fit the format?
I guess I thought maybe things that would suit themselves
harmony
to be played
intensive.
Acoustically and with harmonies. And, you know, again, the structures would be fairly simple. You know, if you overcomplicate it, it can become difficult. But that was it, really. But, harmonies is the main thing. I think we like that. For quite a lot of the show, we're all singing. That's a big part of it. And then of course there's the guitar interplay, I think just you would think about songs that would be suited to this format. Really, that was how you would decide which ones to go for. We do a cover, actually, the first cover that we worked on was a song by a guy called Ben Gibbard, who's a friend of mine. He plays in a band called Death Cab for Cutie. But Ben, a few years back, got to write a song for the last Monkees album, which is really good. Most people haven't heard it. So it's quite a sad album in many ways, but he wrote a song called Me and Magdalena for that record, which is a great song, and I think I maybe let you guys hear it.
It was completely random. We were talking about it in a rehearsal.
Yeah.
And then we sort of sat, and Bernard was coming later that day, and we were like, do you fancy giving that a go?
Yeah.
And then Bernard came in and was like, that sounds great.
I didn't know this song.
Yeah.
I was the only person who didn't know this song, and I didn't actually listen to the record until after we'd been playing it for a while, because I just joined in on this really good song, so it's quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I think that we've got that in one other cover that we do, so I won't reveal the name of that. If people want to know what that is, they'll have to come and see us.
James, you've used the word random a lot, and it does seem to be part of the nature of how that works. Is that quite liberating after having... you know, maybe been in structures for the course of your life, being in bands and being in situations that don't necessarily seem this fluid?
Yeah, it's very liberating, and I think we've all had periods of control freakery in our lives, and it's, sometimes it's nice to share that, and or just, you know, let someone else take the lead and be chilled about it. But it takes a while to get there. I think you need to let your guard down, and a lot of it's trust also. But I also think, you know, when we talk about harmonies and all that, I think when you sing harmony with other people, you can forge an emotional connection with them as well, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, for singer-songwriters, solo performance is really... I've not done it that often. I've done a few solo things. It's really difficult. It's all on you, and you have to make it flow, and you have to... When I started doing solo shows, I got to the part where there would be a solo, and I thought, "What do you do here? What do you do at this bit?" I would maybe start humming
a loop,
or
pedal.
A
loop pedal is the trick.
So with this, we kind of share the burden, you know, because we'll go from.
Each. Well, we would do solo shows all the time, me and Bernard, and this is luxurious. Compared to a solo show, you know,
The pressure's on.
You don't feel the same kind of pressure.
I know it's very early days to ask a question like this, but for all of you, maybe Bernard, I'll ask you this one. What do you think that this project and working like this is going to bring to everything else that you do then going forward from here?
What's it bringing to other stuff? Everything you do in music is about learning, and if you don't think you're learning at any point, then you've stopped. And I always feel that as a musician. And I've always felt that since I was 4 years old or whatever. You know, I always just look around for any situation and think, what am I learning and what have I got from this? And what you, basically nicking stuff from everybody else, you know, quite frankly. You know, you just take little things of songwriting that I'm listening to or processes. And it all informs what you do. I mean, for me personally, a lot of it was I didn't do a lot of solo shows for a long time. And I was doing this for the last few years and at the same time as doing this, and it really broke the ice for me, because as James said, it kind of takes the heat off you when you're only singing one every three songs and you're joining in, you haven't got the whole weight of on you, and this has personally given me a huge amount of confidence when I go to write and when I perform, and it has sort of informed the way I do things, the way I record vocals now. It's really helped me inform me how I do that, which it completely changed the process for me.
I'm going to ask you to finish out by playing the 90s. Why this song, and who wants to take that one?
Well, probably Bernard. Yeah.
I said to James last night, what should we do? And he said, these two songs. So he suggested it. See, there you go. There's never decision making is impossible. This song, so it's called the 90s, and it's I'm really frank, obviously, just putting in the title. This is about the 90s, and because I think I'm obviously very wrapped up in that that period from what people know about my history, and it was on my brain, and I think we were having conversations about this the last couple of years. There's so much of that revival going on in the last couple of years and a sense of nostalgia, and I just think I wanted to sort of look at it a little glimpse from my memory, which isn't always rose-tinted as nostalgia wants you to be. So nostalgia always wants you to just tell the good stuff and just forget about anything else. And I think I just wanted to talk a little bit about the battle in my head that goes on about my own past and just be really honest about it. And I don't think that wouldn't apply to anybody. Everybody's got a little battle. Everybody wants to remember that great night out they had when they were a student or something like that, and they want to forget about all the other bad bits, you know. So I'm just sort of redressing that just in my head, and but it's very frank.
My memory of it was I went the chapter door, Norman, we were just working for 2-3 days full on, and you were like, Bernard's got a cracker. So it was like you just go and sit down and get the guitar out and start playing along, and then 3 hours later it was recorded.
Bernard Butler, Norman Blake, James Grant, it has been an absolute pleasure having you on.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Always the first to say that I was wrong. We've been loving the 90s for far too long. Oh, I'm picking a fight on the Parliament Walk. Pushing up daisies, we're my dog. I'm starting to think I should have stayed at home. But a memory's happy when I'm on my own. Oh, a memory's happy when I'm on my own.
Silence is here to stay. Oh, we've been loving you now more than I can say. Cause you're always the first to say that I was wrong. We've been loving the 90s for far too long. But you buy my drum, you buy the gun, who is Sally anyway? Oh, but you, don't you buy my drum. Someone to argue with my dialogue. Whoa, loving the 90s is here to stay. We've been loving you now more than I can say. I guess you're always the first to say that I was wrong. We've been loving the 90s for far too long.
That was one of the most enjoyable things I've done so far on Arena. My thanks to Bernard Butler, Norman Blake and James Grant for joining me earlier today in Studio 8. Butler, Blake and Grant will be at the Set in Kilkenny tonight, the Town Hall Theatre in Galway tomorrow, Dunkern Theatre in Belfast this coming Thursday and at the Ambassador in Dublin on Friday night. Full ticket details are at mcd.ie and we'll have tickets to that Friday night gig in the Ambassador to be won here tomorrow night on the programme. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Hymn to All the Restless Girls is the latest poetry collection from Donegal poet Anne-Marie Nicoron. The girls in question include her own grandmother and public figures like Sinead O'Connor, Annie Murphy and Bridget Cleary, women often seen as rebels, truth-tellers and troublemakers. The new poems continue Anne-Marie's interest in folklore and myth, often rooted in her native Northwest and in archives of institutions like the mother and baby homes. She is also the 2025 Arts Council UCD Writer in Residence, and she is the poetry editor at the Stinging Fly magazine. Anne-Marie Nicoron joins me now on the line from New York. Anne-Marie, you're in Brooklyn. What has you there?
I'm in beautiful, leafy Brooklyn, and you know, New York is part of Lenape Hoking, the ancestral lands of the Lenape people. And I've had this lovely opportunity to be at the Hawthornden Foundation House to connect with Indigenous poets and poetry. So I'm having such a lovely time just in exploring how our native Irish traditions and rituals, you know, connect us across all of these borders and cultures.
Okay, talk to me about the collection, about Hymn to All the Restless Girls. It's a great evocative title for a book. There's a nod there to the late writer and poet Leland Bardwell. Would you remind us who Leland was and what she meant to you specifically?
Oh, well, Leland kind of changed my life because I was a teenager when I was invited to a poetry workshop at the old Poets' House in Falkara. And I had no idea at that time what a poetry workshop was. I was expecting kind of tools and a workshed and lots of broken things that would get repaired. And, you know, funnily enough, that's kind of what happens in a poetry workshop. But I walked into the room and this lady was sitting in front of the fire with a glass of whiskey, and her name was Leland Bardwell, and she was leading the workshop. And I was completely smitten by her courageous poetry and her sense of wildness, like she was really an original restless girl. And I came out of that poetry workshop and I thought, wow, I want to have a life in poetry.
That must have made some impression on you. How old were you at the time?
I was 16 at the time, and I grew up in a Gaeltacht culture which is very steeped in song and poetry. But I suppose meeting this woman who wasn't from the community, who had this extraordinary life of travel, who was born, she was born in 1922, and she did have a very restless life, which is beautifully documented in her autobiography, which is called A Restless Life. So that word restless really kind of inspired a lot of these poems and this collection.
I'd like you to read something for us from the collection now. Maybe 18 Candles for Gráinne Mhaoil, the Pirate Queen, which finishes out the collection.
18 Candles for Gráinne Mhaoil, the Pirate Queen. A candle for your first crossing through a squall. A candle for your bald raven skull. A candle for your lip-spitting thistles. A candle for your honey-clover tongue. A candle for your 3 galleys, 20 ships and 200 sailors. A candle for your oar slicing water. A candle for your breast pulsing difficult verses. A candle for your trembling cattle. A candle for your throat when they killed your eldest son. A candle for his wrists adorned with black ribbons. A candle for his comb buried under an elderberry bush. A candle for your rage rising blood moons. A candle for your refusal to kneel for other queens. A candle for the blade tucked in a fur pocket of your coat. A candle for your castle as a pillar of ash, a candle for peace briefly between women, a candle for your last breath shimmering, a candle for this stone fort in which we raise a whiskey glass to your name, meaning born of sun.
And that's from the new collection, Hymn to All the Restless Girls. Anne-Marie, will you talk us through the three sections of the book and how they develop? Because there's dark material in these new poems, but there's a powerful kind of celebratory quality to them as well.
Well, the book is prefaced by a quote from Biddy Jenkinson, who talks about the poet, needing to be as odd as one of the triple-faced monsters with which the Celts depicted Ogma the Omniscient gazing in all directions at once. So I was thinking about that triple face, and that it would be lovely to have the book in three sections. The first section draws from the Donegal County Archives. I was the writer in residence there a few years ago, and it draws specifically from the stories of mothers and children who went through the Stranoller home. The second section, then, it engages with this with rituals and sisterhood through the lens of holy sacraments. It's a reclamation of those sacraments. And then the third section is quite wild, and it's powered by these magical ravens. The restless girls have found a kinship with these omen birds. So the third section is full of the vitality and the energy of the girls. It's in three sections, and it's kind of dark and light interwoven, Rick.
We're definitely going to get to the ravens before we finish. We know from earlier collections like the Poison Glen, for instance, that Donegal is obviously a major influence for you in all kinds of ways. Where do you see its influence in your work, and maybe here in particular in this collection?
Well, I think whilst writing this book, I felt, the hand of my grandmother, Mary Haig, on my shoulder the whole time. She was one of the first storytellers in my life, and she really kind of taught me so much about Donegal culture, about Gaeltacht culture. Her life was full of Beligis folklore and pishruga, superstitions, leisne. Like, she had a great knowledge of women's lore that was very rooted to the place of Donegal. And she also had these stories about travelling in New New York, and stories that, you know, she'd picked up from Scotland. And she gave me a great love of language. So I very much associate Donegal and its places with myth and legends and stories, and the stories carried by women as well. You know, when I think of, like, right up until the 80s, there was such a tradition of men having to leave the communities in Donegal, and it was the women who ran the show. You know, they kind of looked after the houses and the families, and that tradition was there when I was going to school as well. My own father worked away, so. I hope that the book is in tune with the marvellous energy that Donegal women bring to storytelling.
I wonder if you would mind reading According to the Ravens for us, because the raven turns up again and again in this particular collection. What's their place in Irish culture?
Well, I came across this word, Fiacht, that sent me down rabbit holes to try and discover what Fiacht was. And it's actually a word for the art of raven watching. And our ancestors would have looked to the sounds, the many sounds that ravens make, and their flight paths in the sky to try and understand the future. And I thought, what a beautiful tradition, the tradition of raven watching. So I wanted to bring that in some way into the book. So, yes, the raven appears all throughout.
And you're going to read According to the Ravens for us.
According to the Ravens. They're against you because they're young men who don't realise that they're just like the old men. They're against you because they're thieves, and thieves must sleep with one eye open. They're against you because they're tired of your mouth spilling rivers, wells, hawthorns, springs, and you can't pin water to a page. They're against you because they're afraid of who they are without their robes. And unlike purple spurge or a wolf, you refuse to become extinct. They fear that if your heart takes light, the hill might explode into flames. They're against you because they can't rip out your tongue, not easily, not like oil or quartz. They question what you witness, not knowing that you are raised by women who could transform children into feathers and beak. Why should a girl not speak to the horse moon? Why should a young man not climb the fence of the dead in his bare feet and purify the air with sage and juniper?
It's an absolutely spectacular collection. Anne-Marie Na Cuaron, thanks for taking time out to join us on the Arena tonight.
Gurmila Maigat.
Hymn to All the Restless Girls is published by Gallery Press. Now, imagine a brand new play for this festive season on the boards of our National Theatre, featuring stories from 100 years of Dublin life, featuring 100 characters, and at any one time, there are 20 actors on stage. There are ghosts, there are multiple narrators, and stories and characters which evolve and change. Described as a glorious collection of endearing and dastardly Dubliners, it's an ambitious and challenging and engaging piece of theatre. It's called Dublin Gothic. It'll be at the Abbey Theatre from the end of this month. I'm delighted to be joined by the brains behind the play, writer Barbara Bergen, and two of the actors, Emmett Farrell and Sarah Morris. Thank you for joining us on Arena.
Thank you
for having us.
Barbara, let me start with you. When did you first have the idea for Dublin Gothic?
Oh God, I had the idea maybe about 15 years ago. It kind of had a few different, it's had a long journey to get here, really. At first, when I started to write it, I wanted to write a kind of everyday epic of invisible lives. And so, and Dublin was always going to be the backdrop for that. So when I first started writing it, I wrote a big outline, really. And then it just seemed to me that it was too big to be a play. And there were so many characters, and I wanted to write this loser's history, and as soon as I sat down to start writing it, all these kind of losers kept appearing and lining up to be included, and they just got mad, more and more and more characters. So
at the beginning of this, then, set the stage for us. Where are we? At the beginning.
Beginning. So the play takes place over 100 years, and it's about a series of characters who are caught in different iterations of time, and they're kind of struggling against the villain of circumstance to tell their story, really, and to tell their stories. And it's really about how we constantly are always trying to do that in our lives. Is something happens to us, our life changes, and we have to make a story. Our story changes. We make a new story to keep going on.
Given that there are 100 characters in this, so as writer, how do you give each of them a separate identity and a separate voice? Because that can't be easy.
No, but I think that's kind of in the style of the play. The characters are all struggling to kind of grab the story, to take the story, to tell their story, to dignify their choices. And there's actually more than 100 characters.
Has this happened recently?
There's 154 at the last show. But obviously
we've added 54 since.
Not all of them.
Do the Abbey know about this?
They do. And you have two of the actors here who are charged with playing multiple characters.
Okay, I'm going to ask the same question to both of you. Emmett, maybe I'll start with you. So there are 100 characters over 100 years. At any point, there are 20 actors on stage. So how many do you play? What's your role in this?
So luckily, I'm only playing two of the 154, but I play a young guy called Frankie Cummins, and then I play his grandson towards the end of the play, which is no mean feat. I mean, I don't think I'll ever do a play again where I play my own grandson, which is really exciting. But we're all on stage for the entire show, which is really, really incredibly exciting, to be honest. I mean, I don't think you're ever going to see a show like this again. If you've not seen one before, you definitely haven't. It's incredibly dynamic. It's incredibly demanding, but in a really, really exciting and thrilling way. And I think the stories, as Barbara was speaking about, you're going to see are so both tragic but also really funny. I mean, I think you can have one without the other. And we're only speaking before we came on air about some of the language that's in the play. I mean, you'll see language evolve over the course of the 100 years, which is really interesting to see how different words change and different pronunciations kind of and different iterations. But we're only chatting about some of our favourite lines before we came on air. Yeah. Sarah's got a great line in the first act. I don't know if you can.
I have shut your coddle box, yeah, old hair baiter. I'm now hooer.
That'll give you an idea.
Coddle box is good.
Coddle box.
But on that, I think I think it's just really exciting, and I think as Barbara was saying, it's massively ambitious scale, but it's going to be one hell of a night out when you make it to it.
And in terms of your characters, Sarah, how many are you playing? What's your brief in this?
I am playing two characters, so I get to play a beautiful character called Honor, and I then play Honor's great granddaughter called Nell in the second and third act. So. Yeah, I think it's really interesting to play with similarities and familiar threads that will come through and what you may or may not inherit throughout generations. And then also completely the other side of the coin, go completely against it and have a really varied side to the two characters, a contrast. So, yeah, we've been really lucky with Barbara's writing, because an amazing thing that she does within the play is she exposes the character's inner voice, which the audience can hear. And it kind of allows the audience to be at points ahead of the story and or just on the breath with the character. And it keeps it really alive. And I think it's innately theatrical in that element.
It sounds like quite a high wire act for you as a performer.
Oh, it is.
Yes,
I mean,
indeed.
I think sometimes by Saturday we're all so emotional because you're constantly operating on it. The play moves at such a lick and it's so compact, but there's so much in it that kinesthetically as an ensemble, we're really on each other all the time. There really isn't a moment wasted in the play. Mm. There's no exposition that's unnecessary. So we're up to 90.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk to me about the language, Barbara, because I have a list here in front of me. I mean, there are words that we don't use anymore, but were used at various points. I mean, I've got here feculent wench, scutter bucket, blubber puss. Are they all words that existed at one point and have now fallen out of usage?
Some of them are, and some of them are just words I made up, to be honest.
That's the writer of the writer.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of a feature of the play as well. So it's a Dublin that's kind of both familiar and strange. And it's very much as kind of a shadow history as well. So these are kind of characters and stories that are not, I suppose they're not, there's historical characters in them, but they're kind of conflations of historical characters. So it's kind of myth busting, yeah. I suppose, if you like. So it's, and I think the humour in the piece is very reflective of Dublin. Yeah. And obviously that's a big inspiration as well.
I'm interested, as the writer, at what stage when you've written this, did you start to then think about what it would look like on stage, how it would be directed, how it would be performed?
Yeah, well, I mean, when you're writing, a lot of the time you're writing in isolation, and I think once Caroline Byrne, who's the director, came on board and we did some workshops with it and we developed a kind of dialogue between ourselves about it. And she has brought such an incredible vision to the piece and assembled this artistic team. So I think what people are going to see is, like, it's kind of beyond my wildest dreams. When I was writing it, I kept thinking, who's ever going to be able to make this? Do you know? It's kind of, it's so challenging in that way. And the team that are bringing it to life, I mean, everyone seems to have taken that and just gone, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah.
And I can do it, like, brilliantly. So we're really so lucky to have that.
It's extraordinarily ambitious, but everyone is singing off the same hymn sheet in terms of both behind the desk and in front. So the whole team is really excited.
And on that, I mean, like, when you walk into the theatre, I mean, you'll be, once that gauze goes up and you're confronted with the set as well, but the song with Jamie Barton, it's amazing. It's incredibly, I used the word dynamic earlier on, where we're going to very much have to be on such an exploratory set, but also it's amazing to see and amazing to get to play on as well. I mean, just to touch base with what Barbara said there as well about those stories. I mean, like, the set kind of lends itself to it is a tragedy, but it's also very, very funny at the same time. Yeah. Like, we were just said to Barbara before we came on, like, one of my favourite quotes is by Charlie Chaplin, and he said, life's a tragedy in close-up, but a comedy in long shot. And I think, actually, when you're playing those characters throughout the different acts, it is quite tragic in those close-ups, but then when you take a step back and you see the scale of the scale of the production as a whole, it is that long shot kind of thing over the course of the 100 years.
Time has just caught up on us. I am, however, conscious that I feel as though tonight's interview feels a little bit like what the performance is going to be like.
Yes, definitely so much.
And I'm glad that has worked out that way. Thanks so much for joining me in studio tonight, Barbara Bergen, Emmett Farrell and Sarah Morris. Dublin Gothic is at the Abbey Theatre from the 26th of November. The previews are from the 22nd. And for more details, the website is, of course, abbeytheatre.ie. That is it for Tuesday night's Arena. Sheila O'Callaghan was the producer. Paula Shields is our researcher, broadcast coordinator, Ollie Hamilton, and sound supervision tonight by Niall McMonagle. I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7. John Creedon is after the news.